Welcome to the Cinephile Hissy Fit Podcast, brought to you by the Ruminations Radio Network and sponsored by Film Obsessive. This is the tirade-filled movie debate hosted by two film critics, cool dads, and struggling teachers. I'm Don Shanahan.
Well, looky here, a little octagon here. Is that too Irish for you?
I think that's right enough Irish for what we're looking here for.
I think you know? For this movie, that was pretty Irish. Exceptional Irish. No, I'm William Johnson, not Irish.
Take a swab test from, you know, Ancestry 26 or whatever we're supposed to do here.
I'm white enough that I probably have some kind of European blood in me somewhere.
Well, you know, if you play your cards right next time you're in Chicago, you can have a little Irish in you that way. But no, sorry, not that one. All right, no. Ladies and gentlemen, we're damn glad to have you folks because I used to fuck guys like Will in prison. This is all for tantrum's sake. We're shared passions and high fives. Wow. Wash away any place for hate, no matter what. We encourage you all to love what you love. But for now, the gloves are off and the Irish fit is on. This is not a St. Patrick's Day movie, but all of a sudden we're here laughing and talking about the new Roadhouse to follow up the episode we recently did on the old Roadhouse. So, this week, our format is the same. The recommending lover goes first. They'll get 5 uninterrupted minutes to shower their praise and state their high-minded case. The hater, if there is one between us, follows with 5 uninterrupted minutes of their own to present their counterpoints with any manner of intellectual scorched earth. After that, we'll open it up for about a half hour of shared conversation where the hits fit really gets chippy, and I promise we're not going to put any Irish into Will. So let's go.
Yeah, and there's really no, I mean, as is the case, I like to think weird comp of the day. I like to think we're kind of like MacGyver. Like we started out this podcast being fundamentally about having hissy fits about cinema in which we disagree about things. But I don't think we've actually done something where we've disagreed in a long time.
I know.
And the reason why I say it's like MacGyver is because in MacGyver, like the first couple seasons was very clearly just about a dude who makes things out of rudimentary, you know, fundamental, just random objects.
Yeah.
And then like by season 4 or 5, it became like, let's stop gang warfare and guns are bad. And it was like, it was not what the show was. But unlike MacGyver, we have not dipped in quality. We're only getting better, but there really is no hater on this episode.
No,
you and I are only differentiated by a half, which you loathe. That's probably the only hissy fit we'll have is the half system in ratings. I use halves. You do not.
No, I definitely don't. And it's just cleaner and easier that way. There's a little more conviction to, you know what? It falls off to a 2. Thank you very much. You know, that kind of thing where, I feel like this, I feel the same way where, we started very diametrically opposed, like fuck that guy on Twitter, that Don guy, you know, we were very at odds, but then I think the fun part about this is, the longer we've been doing this and the longer, and this shouldn't feel full circle from one week to another to do old Roadhouse and new Roadhouse, but just, and maybe it's the editorials we've been doing lately, but like, I think the places that we're hissifitting are everyone else, you know, like we have found the right wavelength. We found the right place where we are. We found our cover levels. They differ, you know, like when we do our top 10 shows at the end of the year, your list is completely different than mine, you know, but at the same time we find, we both have found a way to, I don't know, refine our lenses through each other. Like you tell me that you're skipping some trailers and you know, and lowering some expectations. I find myself, you know, going into genres and places I wouldn't normally, doing some of the deep dives that you do and thinking about things the way you do. And like, we've made each other better 150 episodes into this thing. And it's,
I guess the point of all this is that like, I don't even think, well, you and I are probably, because we're basically on the same wavelength here with this film, we're going to go against the grain as usual, because basically every person that I follow, friend-wise, and even some critics, you know, just hate this thing. So you and I talked about it last night. We were just like, hey, that's not bad, but. I guess I'll use that as, since I'm technically the lover, because I was half a star higher than you.
You are a half star higher. Enjoy the first 5.
At 3.5. 3.5. But yeah, as I said in the last episode, you know, I'm not particularly beholden to Roadhouse as some kind of seminal film experience that it is for a lot of people that grew up in that time period. I totally get it. We talked about it last week when I had watched it for the first time, and I was watching it with Don, who had seen it for, you know, since he was 10 or 11 or whatever. So I get it. There's a lot of movies like that. I'm sure another huge movie that I've never seen. I'm sure if it ever got remade would be, you know, something like The Goonies, which I've never seen actually in full. I'm sure that that's something that, you know, there's so many people that are so attached to that film because of their childhoods and things like that, that seeing it remade would probably offend them. But then for someone like me who will eventually watch it because now it has an Academy Award winner in it of Ki-Hoo Kwan, and I would like to see a young Josh Brolin, I might watch that, but I will never, just because of the experience, ever be beholden to beholden to The Goonies. And I get it. People are really beholden to Roadhouse. So I can understand a remake ruffling some feathers. But what I really liked about this movie, and I did like it, I gave it 3.5. For me, like, 3 stars is the average. Like, if you're talking about, like, you know, wins above replacement player in baseball, like, you know, this is, like, to me, like a 1 or a 0.5. It's better than the average movie. A 3 for me is at 0. You know, that's basically, like, the movie did its job. It didn't do anything spectacular, but it wasn't bad. And so 3.5 means it's a little bit better than average to me. And it was. I think that having just watched the original, they took the idea and decided, okay, we can't just remake this thing. So, like, word for word or style for style. So they made some interesting changes. And actually, I was kind of, I'm not going to say impressed, but I was kind of happy that they kind of brought up some stuff that I had brought up on the podcast, which the two things they mentioned was, this is kind of an older tale, you know, it kind of has that Western feel. And actually, there's a character in this movie that talks about the Western hero who comes from out of town, sets the ship right, and then leaves, right? And they actually bring that into the plot with a literary character, a character who's really into books and things, and mentions that, you know, Dalton is this kind of, you know, Western hero who comes in. So they took the spirit of what the first Roadhouse was, took the skeleton of the idea, and made enough changes to make it not derivative. Like, I you know what's going to happen in this kind of story, but you also know what was going to happen in Roadhouse when you watched in 1989. I mean, it has similar story beats. It's just, it's not a necessarily very subversive idea. So in order to subvert the unsubversible, really, you have to just change some things. And this movie did a really good job of, like, changing location, changing the background history, changing the villains slightly, modifying it a little bit for current times, changing the stakes a little bit, getting rid of some characters, adding others. It made enough changes to make it its own thing. I do think one of the flaws of the film is that the Roadhouse itself kind of gets lost a little bit in this picture, because the first one, no matter whatever side adventures we ended up going on with Dalton and everything, the focus of the film was still the Double Deuce, the Roadhouse itself. And this one, the Roadhouse just kind of feels like, though it's really cool and I would love to visit it, and the music's great, just like it was in the first one, it doesn't really become a centerpiece of the story. So this does kind of sway towards generic actioner. But it does have some great performances in it. I'm not saying this is detailed three-dimensional stuff, but Jake Gyllenhaal is channeling his Ryan Gosling in The Gray Man with, you know, very sly, dry one-liners and having that masculinity that isn't intimidating but also is at the same time. It's kind of a high mixture, someone who's incredibly handsome and who obviously is built like a Mack truck but doesn't carry himself like it. And then I got a hand, I was skeptical, but Conor McGregor does exactly what he was told to do, which is ham this fucker up. He makes a compelling villain. That's one of the benefits, I think, of this movie over the original, is that they give the physical heavy. There's a physical heavy in the first one, but he really is only there to perform some moves and be like a general threat. This guy has this bizarre, you know, cocksure, crazy attitude, and it really brings a maniacal and fun presence to the film. So if anything, if you come to this movie and you're just like, I just want to see a couple of jacked guys fight each other and crack some one-liners and just do some wild things, then I mean, this is the movie for you. It's not gonna change your life, it's not gonna win any Oscars, but it's definitely gonna be a good time for you. So tighten up and just watch it.
Well done, sir.
Thank you.
No, I love how you started with the word beholding, because if anyone should be, it'd be a guy like me who has loved this movie since he was 10 years old, watches it plenty of times. You know, it's that rewatchable track of movie where it's a crazy for Swayze, you know, OG. Yeah, I should be hating this movie just on principle. But no, I'm with you. I'm some of this is my maturity of becoming a better, you know, better critic, better watcher, where we talked about this last time with Roadhouse and other things, where I've learned that, you know, to let the fandom go and understand that, hey, you know, no remake will ever erase or replace an original, where let them do their own thing, let them be their own thing. If the older one ends up being superior, you still got it and you still can enjoy it. And if this one just happens to be a fun time or its own thing or something different, now your love gets to multiply. It's like having a second kid, you know what I mean? And yeah, this movie is a blast, because like you said, just to get two jacked guys who beat the shit out of each other and some fantastic stunt work and camera work to kind of put yourself in a fight where you're, you know, almost like the camera's almost like a chest cam on a cop for a second there, where you're getting your, you know, your chin knocked in by Conor McGregor. And yeah, so there's enough inventiveness where in my review, I kind of asked where, like, what do you come back to Roadhouse for? You know, do you come back to the Swayze movie in 89 for Swayze? Do you come back for Kelly Lynch? Do you come back for Sam Elliott? Or do you come back for the sweaty, awesome action? And I have to think for most people, they come back for the action. So as long as a new one can get that right, and the characters never, you can't replicate Patrick Swayze, you can't replicate the 80s. So as long as you get some fighting to do pretty good and get some meaty, good action, that's probably enough. And this movie has that in spades, where I'm with you with Conor McGregor coming in. And I had same thing. I had so low hopes, like, what's this going to be? Because a lot of these times, these non-actors who come in, they'll be a dialogue that's just kind of heavy. They just kind of sit in the background, punch when they need to. They don't get a lot of, you know, camera time or showmanship. And Conor just comes in. And like you said, full pulled pork off the roasted hog on the Spitfire, where he just, yep, it's all him. And he's awesome, because you have to then realize, like, damn, that's Conor fucking McGregor, you know. And I'm enough of a UFC fan where I just remember him just being a terror. And then at the same time, the gift of gab and the loquacious guy in the mic. So when you have that, that's enough. But like you said, to see the changes that they've done to the updated setting, this is the Dominican Republic kind of, you know, sitting in for Florida, and it looks great. I'm with you. That bar is gorgeous. You know, the Tiki Hut, the high A frame, like, that would be a place I would love to hang out to, between the music and the people and that beach, you know, a couple of stones throw away. Oh my goodness, what a place just to chill. So I think there's other things that the movie's missing. I'll get to that in the 30 here a little bit. But just to come in and be its own thing, to modernize it up, to, you know, question the things we laughed about last time. Like, what happens to, like, where's the law in this situation? Well, we've got some law this time. You know, where's the litigious people who are here, like, hey, you punched me in my face. Well, got a little bit of that too, you know. And you know, when you have a hero that can drive the people he beats up to the hospital, you've got a 2024 action movie, that's for sure. So props to Jake, props to Connor. This is a good time. Again, nothing earth shattering. You'll never pass the original, but yeah, you could do worse on a nice little spring break weekend than put this on and just, you know, just cheer, just kind of pump your fist, chug a beer, and enjoy a good movie on the couch.
Nice.
Yeah. Hang tight and please enjoy this short announcement from the Ruminations Radio Network.
You've seen Twin Peaks all the way through, but all you have are spoiler-free discussions? At Blue Rose Task Force Podcast, no information is classified and nothing beats the listening sensation when production history collides with deep theory. Put the coffee on.
All right, welcome back. Yeah.
Well, one thing I wanted to that mm-hmm. I didn't get to address in my 5 minutes is sure. There's a little bit of give and take with this remake. And while I think that they did a good job on beefing up certain aspects from the original that weren't there,
yeah,
there are a couple of things that are missing that I do think hurt it a little bit.
Let's see if yours match mine.
So two things. One is by not having kind of the same musician as a character, it kind of creates a, I don't know, like, there's not a lot of, since the movie kind of has trouble being consistent with the actual Roadhouse itself.
Yeah.
By having kind of different types of music in there. There's not that consistent tone. The cool thing about the original Roadhouse is that Jeff Healey band, and that was kind of like its own character in a way, because the music was kind of flowing through it.
Yeah, and he had a history with Dalton. Dalton knew him. Like, it was just one more character to kind of be on the good guy side of the Survivor Series match.
It added like depth to the actual Roadhouse itself.
I get why they did this one, where like if you have more bands, then you have a wider, richer soundtrack. And like if they're trying to sell an LP album on this, you've got one by having five bands instead of one.
And I actually enjoyed all the music.
Yeah, damn good music.
I didn't think it was bad. No. But the other thing was, even though they did a wonderful job, though, actually, while you were doing your 5 minutes, I was arguing with a friend of the show, Lauren, about Conor McGregor.
Okay. I was going to bring up Lauren in this show too. Go ahead.
Though I think that they did a great job beefing that particular character. I don't remember what the character's name is. The
Johnny. Job. Yeah. With the pole vault and all that. Yeah.
Yeah. By beefing that character up, it gives him much more menace to the.
Oh, hell yeah. He's the scary thing. As fuck.
But I think one thing that is missing, though, that they did not have is kind of that best friend, that Sam Elliott character.
I'm with you.
Really kind of hurts a little bit, because I kind of feel like Gyllenhaal. I mean, he's charismatic. He's a wonderful actor. He can carry the screen. But I think like somebody on this journey needs to have an ally, you know, like,
I agree.
And it's like an ally who knows him. I mean, obviously, like,
yeah,
they do a decent job of, they're not quite as colorful as in the original, like the bouncers and the barmaids and the stuff like that. They're not quite as effective that they are in the original. But I mean, they try to do a good job of like creating this, and they give a little bit more character to the owner of the Roadhouse.
A little bit, yeah, yeah.
But, yeah, missing that, someone who was there for him in the past in some kind of ambiguous way, like Sam Elliott was.
Yeah.
Also, in the first one, even though I was critical of the fact that, like, the bad guy kind of went from, like, creepy developer to, like, murderous, like, tycoon by killing Sam Elliott, like, I think somebody like McGregor killing, like, his friend would add to the stakes a little bit. And
yeah, I agree.
And I'll get on that too about the stakes later. I'll let you of course speak, but I do have another problem with that. But so there's some give and take. There's some things they did really well with the remake style, changing things up. And then, but unfortunately there's also some things missing, I think.
Yeah. I got two things that I think are still missing. That one match is yours. One follows a little further. I'm with you. You do need kind of a number two tag team partner, good guy, kind of co-headliner, like, and it doesn't necessarily, like you say, have to be a sage Sam Elliott wisdom kind of guy, like his corner man for when he was UFC. But like, even if there was like, you know, an equal age guy who's like the old sparring partner who never let him go after the UFC thing went down, and like, just you need like that backup, you know, the guy you can call when you're in a pinch, just the way Swayze did in the first one, where, hey, I got a little issue, can you come by and help me out? And then at the same time, it creates those camaraderie scenes that we enjoy in the first one, the diners, the dances, you know, it matches, it gives you a few more scenes with the love interest, and you can kind of just see then he's not just, like you said, so the main character's not such a zen weird loner, because he's got people, he's got history, and you don't have that in this movie. And I think that's the largest missing thing that this movie is lacking, is that number two hero. I do like those two young guys, that two nice little actors that are like the little bartender, or like you said, the bouncer, one of my apprentices or something like that.
Sure,
almost.
Sure.
Like those two guys are nice little young actor guys. They've got some history. I've looked up their screen credits, where that'd be a nice place to see where they go. And you're right. Jessica Williams, for like, at least for the first half of the movie, is, and obviously you got to love having a woman and a person of color in here for a little bit, just to kind of make this a little more wide, well-rounded. And she has a good convicted sense, like you said, as an owner, where those pieces are brought up a little bit, you know, but yeah, missing Sam Elliott is one thing. And then, the other second thing that I think the movie's missing a ton of is, and this is a hat tip to Lauren Knight and her little diatribe we've been enjoying for the last month on social media. This movie's not hot enough and steamy enough. Like, that love interest from Daniela Melacuar, just isn't, the sparks aren't there. Not to say Kelly Lynch is like, you know, a drop dead bombshell smoke show, but in this case, compared to where we're at with this doctor, not so much, where the current one, that is, where, I mean, when Kelly Lynch was there and you get that love scene where they're banging against that barn wall, like, or barn wall. I mean, it just, you know, and Lauren brings this up on social media, like, movies aren't horny anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And the old Roadhouse was a completely horny movie. You've got, you know, topless dancers and striptease scenes with Julia Michaels. You've got Kelly Lynch coming in like a, you know, just all guns blazing hot, you know, and obviously you have sex scenes, you have a love story angle that's got a little deeper than just sharing some good times. And just the movie was just steamier. There's some sizzle there. And I think despite the great setting of Florida and the beach where you could really have a great time, you just don't have that. Like cracking beers with some lawn chairs and a boat, that's all you get out of these two. And yeah, it just that's missing nice, to me.
Here's a nice thing too. I would have preferred, since they were already switching things up, instead of kind of having that forced love interest with someone who's related to the town, I actually think they should have done it with the owner, Jessica Williams. I think her name is Frankie in the movie. Like I thought that would have been better.
Yeah.
If she kind of like falls in love with his style or whatever, by, you know, she ends up being like a very interesting character because she has a lot of you know, like she has character. She has more dimensionality than the common than the common actioner person. But I think, and not to say that women can't have multiple roles in these movies.
Oh, sure, yeah.
But I just feel like it does feel like Daniela Melchior. Is that how you pronounce it, or Melchior? Or
I thought it was Melchior, but I'm not sure.
Melchior, but yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah. But by having her in there, you know, it just it's an extra plot point that I feel like you could just build that with the with Frankie and have that just and double dip there, because you're already expanding certain things from the original and taking other things away.
Yeah. Even the conversational chemistry, like that first scene where Frankie meets our guy Dalton in the parking lot after that underground fight that kind of gets waved off because they're like, holy shit, it's that guy. I'm not fighting that guy. Like their banter in the parking lot is better and flirtier than anything with Daniela.
Yeah, that's why I thought it was going to go that route. You can go there for
sure. Yeah.
I really thought it was going to go that route. And really, well, and this comes up with my other issue with, and this was a problem in the first one too. I mentioned this in the episode, is that the kind of philosophy of this character, Dalton, is bizarre because, in both versions, this is someone who is haunted by something they've done that crossed a certain line, and both movies have that line about no one wins in a fight, blah blah blah.
Yeah.
Blah. But to add to a little bit of the, I mean, there is already kind of a insanity with the Conor McGregor character. I mean, he's you know, he's walking around like Italy naked or something, and then like you know, like he's just crazy, like, you know, just crazy. Jake Gyllenhaal kind of turns into like a freaking serial killer at the end of this movie.
He sure does,
and,
man.
And it's like I get it, he's snapped, but like it doesn't really make sense that, I mean, I guess maybe there was something in him that snapped when he fought his friend.
Maybe.
And that's what he's scared of. And maybe, but I wish they explored kind of like,
well, that's, okay,
he knows he has that in him.
Yeah.
But I think like the way he turns it out, like the way it turns out, it feels like he enjoys it
a little bit. I think you're right. Like, yeah.
But
I'm wondering that.
But it makes it kind of like the Swayze version, where it's kind of like he's this haunted philosophical man, you know, that shouldn't kill or whatever.
Yeah.
Whatever. But then he kind of enjoys it at the end. Even the Swayze one didn't do that. But I don't know. It just, that was kind of a mixture, because suddenly it's just like, hey, I've become the person I shouldn't be. It just seemed at odds with the conflict of the character.
I agree. In
the first place. So,
I mean, it's tricky because, like, a couple of things that kind of, I think, plug into this and tie this up in a good way, if it's there, is one of it is Jake's not going for the Zen thing that Swayze does at all. I mean, he's kind of I'm not saying he's a Marvel wiseacre, you know, where he's like, every line's a joke, but like, he's doing the cup of coffee thing. He's, you know, he's doing the teetotaler route, and he's, you know, he doesn't have to say be nice, or he doesn't have that leadership quality. He just, in fact, sits at the bar more often than I thought he would in terms of the fighting stuff, where he's not coming in as like a leader of men, so to speak, where some of that stature kind of helped the Zen, the leader, the philosophy angle from Swayze. We don't have that here. I think another piece that that's not lifting what Jake needs to be, or at least what that character needs to be, is again, that Sam Elliott character, that guy who can kind of like, you know, because like there's that scene with Elliot and Swayze where he's like, hey, man, you know what you did in Memphis wasn't bad. Like, just the reassuring guy who's like, hey, you know, that wasn't your mistake. You know, I know we don't need to hear it because we can watch it. But that second character, that number two hero, would help that hero's journey along. I think the third thing would be is, and I was wondering this, kind of your opinion on this, is in the first movie, we have no Patrick Swayze flashbacky backstory at all. We have the rumors of, oh my God, that's Dalton. Oh my God, that's Dalton. We have the reputation that's talked around. And then we have Sam Elliott coming in and just kind of walking us through a few little things about himself or about Swayze, about Dalton. Whereas this movie has full on flashbacks to, you know, the world building origin of Elwood Dalton. Is that too much? Did you even? Because
I
like the mystique of the first one versus the over-explaining of this one.
No, because I actually, just like with the main villain, I think it's modernized. Because Patrick Swayze killing someone, you know, I'm
in
assuming, like, that's not going to be everywhere. But, like, his legend is based off viral, you know, popularity. Like, he can't escape it because it's literally everywhere. Like, if people see him, they go, oh shit, that's the guy that killed that guy in the ring. I've seen the footage. I've seen him kill that person. So I mean, I wouldn't blame him for, like, you know, I mean, that's one thing I liked about his character, that it's not zen like Swayze, but like he is kind of this what's that term for people that don't use technology?
Luddite. That's the one.
Like, he doesn't even like to drive. He likes to walk everywhere. He doesn't like to use computers. Right? He doesn't have a phone. You know, so I kind of like that, because that is, in his way, in this modern day, is kind of zen-like, because you have no outside influences. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And with being obviously a famous person who had a very horrible thing happen, that's him getting off the grid going, I don't want to fucking see it. I don't want to get to add to that. You're right. That's the modern thing of, like you said, in 1989, the viral reputation of this really cool bouncer maybe killed a guy is one thing. Today, you're a news headline. You've got data.
Well, there's also, you know, to fit with the Western theme, like,
true,
you know, like, when you think about the Western and they kind of know this guy by name, you know, there's always that, I heard he killed six guys in Utah, you know, whatever. There's kind of a legend to it. Like, everyone kind of knows the story, but doesn't know the story. Whereas this is, everyone's seen it.
Inescapable. They've
seen him. Yeah. They've seen him kill. And I think seeing something makes it a little bit more impactful than what's in your imagination. Because in your imagination,
and that'll change an attitude to it. Right.
Yeah. So
I liked it,
actually. I liked the flashbacks.
Yeah.
And I also thought they were creatively shot and interesting.
Of course.
Like, it wasn't a typical, like, you know, 24 years ago. Like, it like,
for all we know, it was 2 years ago. Yeah.
Yeah, it was very haunting for him, and I thought it was effective. I actually didn't mind that, and to stick to the modernization theme, I did kind of enjoy Billy Magnuson as Ben Brandt, as instead of it being like this self-made, which is kind of also modern, instead of it being like
Eddie's
this,
money,
instead of being like this self-made, you know, quote unquote self-made millionaire billionaire that, you know, has this empire that he wants to protect and expand. This is daddy's boy trying to be what his dad is, which is clearly some kind of organized crime criminal, you know, but doing it the business way.
Yeah, the real estate takeover stuff.
But being kind of this preppy douche that's not quite, you know, like, I thought it was an engaging character, and also clearly not threatening enough.
No.
Because I thought another weakness of the original was, by the time you get to the final showdown of Ben Gazzara and Patrick Swayze, I mean, I was kind of like,
well, there's no chance unless Ben Gazzara has a gun, you know.
Well, and he did the thing, like I said, that they do in Gladiator, which is, you know, Russell Crowe kicked the shit out of Joaquin Phoenix in that movie.
Oh, yeah.
So Joaquin Phoenix has to injure him mortally first, so that's a fair fight. That's what kind of had to happen in the first Roadhouse. This one, they supplement that by having this odd job character that comes in and does all the heavy lifting in terms of violence and stuff. It's a perfect match, so I actually did enjoy that as well. I think all the modern touches to this, and I also think that the Keys, I've been to the Keys, I've lived in Florida, they kind of have a
off the beaten path, disconnected place where things happen there, stay there. You're not,
well, yeah, the, I mean, the Keys are popular, the Keys are popular, but they're not Miami, you know what I mean? So it's kind of got a little bit of a, it's got a little bit of a old school vibe to it. You know, it kind of feels like, you know, we're talking, you know, the Spanish used to own that territory.
That's so
there's a lot of older homes and styles, and it just, it's not like, it's not something that I think people flock to. It's popular, but it's not like a, like I said, it's not Miami. So it's not like something that everybody knows, you know, the sounds and looks of Miami whenever they watch TV. So I think they picked a good location as well.
That's cool.
So, and to make it so that it is possible for someone like him to escape
right
into a place
you are that down is, the road from a big place like Miami. Sure.
Yeah. Cause it's, I mean, he uses the computer every now and then, but
yeah.
For the most part, I mean, there's not a lot of cell phone use in this. There's not a lot of, it's very, it's almost, I wouldn't say 80s, but it's very 90s in its approach of like being kind of simple in terms of, you know, the main gadgets are like transportation, cars and boats and stuff. Yeah. It's not weapons and technology. And I found that kind of, and actually that is kind of the, a nice disconnect between Jake Gyllenhaal and Billy Magnuson is that Billy Magnuson is kind of like that Elon Musk-y, you know, I have all the technology, all the clothes, all the fancy stuff versus the kind of Luddite who doesn't have anything. And it's kind of an interesting dynamic I thought worked really well.
No, I like Magnuson. I know the place I see him the most is like Game Night, where he's normally just kind of a side character, supporting character. He's not really a boob. He's not really the comedian. You know, but for here to see him kind of play, you know, like you said, kind of a pussy, but a half heavy and a douchebag, you know, like it fit for him. I think that tone sitting shaving scene where like, you know, like we know it's preposterous that he's getting shaved on this boat. But at the same time, like that's a chance for Billy to be like, hold on a second. Like, let me show just where my edge is at as an edge touches me, so to speak, where like how angry can I get while still being cool enough to get a shave on a boat, you know, like it was just a good demonstration of like what kind of guy we were going to get at the same time as knowing full well, yeah, that guy's not going to kick Jake Gyllenhaal's ass. He's going to have to do it another way with his people and with other things. Yet at the same time, establishing what that can be. I'm with you where the owner, like you said, the roadhouse itself does disappear. I mean, yeah, the whole climax, the boat crashes into it and we're going to have the fight in the roadhouse, but like the fate, so to speak, of the roadhouse is just kind of left to the side easily in the last third of the movie for sure. For the boat chase and all the other stuff where it's the doctor gets, who just happens to be the sheriff's daughter, gets kidnapped and turns into a damsel in distress for the ending. And that was a little weak sauce, but it got us to Connor and Jake. So it's fine.
I was a little nervous too, because for about 5 minutes there, it looked like he was going to like play investigator and like investigate all this shit.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, and I was like please don't do that. Thankfully they didn't go down that path because it's obvious why they need the land. Like it's pretty clear, like why they fucking need it. Like it doesn't take a detective to figure out like, oh, ocean access on, you know,
everything going to the left, everything going to the right. Gosh, what does he want in the middle? Oh, the place he doesn't have.
Possibly want. So thank God they didn't go down that route, but you and I talked about it last night. It was, it was fun, and that's all it needs to be. We talked about this a little bit in our Bradley Cooper episode, which I don't know if it'll be released before or after. We talked about Bradley Cooper and the whole idea of trying too hard and film criticism and everything. And I think like, and I mentioned it with sports. It's like, you know, because one guy isn't as good as the other, you know, in sports, like they're discredited completely. And it just kind of forgets the point that there can be great things that are simple. There can be good things. Yep. There doesn't have to be, not everything has to be this subversive,
that's the thing,
life changing, greatest of all time masterpiece or disaster piece thing. Sometimes you can just, I mean, I was more excited to watch this than a lot of other stuff because I just sat down. I was like, okay, it's Friday night. I just got back from work, busy week. This is going to be a cinch. Like I don't have to overthink. I can just sit down and enjoy. And I did, I got exactly what I wanted. Mm-hmm. And I think that's getting lost in the middle. Like we can't have these middle movies anymore.
Yeah.
Like to me, this 3.5 is, you know, I would say more rewatchable and enjoyable than something I gave like 4.5 or 5.
Absolutely.
Like Poor Things or something. You know what I mean?
Oh,
like,
yeah.
It's just kind of, I guess I was going to put this on Twitter, but like, to me, like it applies mostly in sports, but it applies to movies too, is the GOAT debate and the ring debate and the championship debate has ruined nuance and appreciation of things that are good and or great. Because if it's not the greatest and it's not the worst, then it's nothing. And that's kind of frustrating because
I think you're right. That comes over here in film criticism.
And this has kind of got stuff going against it, because everyone is, a lot of people anyway, not everyone, but a lot of people are going up against this, saying not only is it this kind of, you know, quote unquote generic actioner, but it's also a remake of a beloved film. So it's kind of got all these strikes against it. Whereas I saw that as a benefit. I saw that. I saw the chances they were taking. This could have been very well, could have been a very, you know, cynical cash grab by just remaking the first film, but they actually tried with something here.
And that's
what people have been complaining about forever now, is like, no one tries anything. They actually tried with this movie to make it something of its own. And that's great.
Same. I'm right there with you where, don't get me wrong. I made my list of like, I wouldn't mind a number two hero. I wouldn't mind a steamier love story. I wouldn't mind a little this, a little, you know, a little less cops, a little less, you know, but at the same time, like you said, like the floor, like ceiling and floor, to sound like the athletic thing. Like, I don't know what people thought you could squeeze out of this to ever come close to matching or improving in the first. Like, this is a Western motif applied to a fucking bouncer. Like, this wasn't gonna be No Fucking Country for Old Men. at no point was this movie ever gonna have that ceiling. But the floor, so to speak, is grizzled, cool, R-rated, awesome, you know, sweaty and go at it action. They have a star look good doing it, have villains that are colorful and different than your typical, you know, comic book and Fast and Furious lot. And there's zero expectation of franchise or IP, where, you know what, just show up, bang it around and have a good time and be out. And to do that with, and I think that what, for me, the piece that helped this a ton, like you said, from being cash grab, you got Doug Liman here. I mean, Doug Liman is a professional action director, where this movie was never not going to look good. This movie was never not going to be kinetic, because this guy makes Jumper, makes Edge of Tomorrow, makes, you know, all the way back to Swingers, but he's done, you know, Born Identity, the first one. Like, this movie was going to move, you know, this wasn't going to be boring. So that helps a ton. Whereas it, because you could slow this movie down and turn this into, like you said, a ponderous Western, you know, modern anti-misogyny thing. But why, you know? And then, or you're right, you move this thing at 200. Michael Bay takes this and moves this at 200 miles an hour, and it's just fluff, you know. So, yeah, I think they found the right middle ground. I think that's Gyllenhaal. I think not only is it Liman's touch with action, I think it's Gyllenhaal. Gyllenhaal's that one of those actors that I know he was in Spider-Man, but he kind of hasn't been overexposed as an action guy. Like, he's made his boxing movie, he's the Nightcrawler, but he doesn't do this all the time. We know he's jacked, but at the same time, he doesn't, like, he's not overexposed. Like, if this was Dwayne Johnson, we'd be like, ah, fuck, we've seen this already. If this was anybody we've seen a lot, we would just be like, no way, you know, or I know what I'm going to get. But with Jake, you're like, all right, I know Jake is jacked and I know this could go well. And like, all the promo images of this when it was being made was all the very, because it was in front of a big crowd, was all the UFC stuff. Because, I mean, they shot it like at the same time as they did a pay-per-view. So everyone knew, like, oh, Jake's getting jacked up for UFC level stuff. What's going to be there? And so, like, that was enough advertisement as it was. It's like, come see Jake, just be jacked and go. And I'm not saying Jake is Patrick, because I think Patrick, we talked about in the last episode, Patrick has that crossover appeal where guys love him and girls love him. And Jake's not quite that level, but he does have that crossover appeal where he's not just a himbo for the girls and he's not just a doofus for the guys. So, like, he can do a bit of both. So,
well, I want to bring up something that you mentioned about, you know, the fact that this isn't steamy. So,
I'm gonna beat Lauren Knight's drum on this one. This movie could be a whole lot hotter. Yeah.
So here's the issue that I have. I think because of the gratuity of things like the 80s. Okay.
True.
I mean, don't get me wrong. Like, am not preaching to my daughters that, you know, wet G-string contests.
Well, for no, the sake don't of
wet G-string contests are okay. However, the fundamental aspect of our society as people is finding someone that we find attractive.
True.
We have kind of been shamed into finding people attractive because...
Oh, not that everything's in metric on apps? Oh, yeah, we have. Well, you're right.
Because, okay, so for example, I remember a while back, somebody had tweeted something about, like... I think there was a movie. Quote me if I'm wrong. If I'm wrong, I'm sorry. I'm trying to remember, but I think this is when Ty West X was coming out with
Mia Goth, right?
Mia Goth, right? And Jenna Ortega was in it. Okay,
yeah, she was.
Now we'll throw out kind of the weirdness of the fact that she is like 18 at the time, and
right,
you know, that it's just weird. It's kind of like that Hermione effect where like men were waiting for Hermione to turn 18 or whatever. It's weird.
Yeah,
we won't get into any of that stuff. But I remember somebody posted, like a critic, he said something on like Twitter or something like, "Oh, Jenna Ortega is not naked in this movie, so I gave it one less star." Now he was like taken to the rails for daring to see someone naked. I'm sorry, you will not meet anyone on this planet that if you see someone hot, you don't want to not see them naked.
I mean, did this with Sydney Sweeney, you know? She's got 2-3 movies in the pike right now where everyone's like, but it's Sydney Sweeney, and Sydney Sweeney's done that already on television, where I'm not saying she carries an expectation, but all of a sudden it's like, whew, you know, it's Sydney Sweeney.
I think people forget the idea of gratuity and exploitation versus...
Well, that's why I'm saying like passion.
What I'm saying is like, I shouldn't be ashamed because I want to see whatever her name is. The Rat Woman from
Suicide That's right. Squad. It's Ratcatcher 2. Right. Rat catcher.
Yeah. Like, I should not feel ashamed for the fact that when I see a very beautiful woman, I shouldn't be like, you know, I wouldn't mind seeing her naked. Like, I shouldn't feel bad for that. Now, should there be equal opportunity? Yes, there's more male nudity in this movie than anything else.
Look at Connor man. Yeah, fucking buns of steel out there.
And I'm all for equal opportunity nudity. Mm-hmm. Like, shout out to the Kevin Bacons and the Harvey Keitels of the world who are I'm going to show my junk. So I'm not saying like, hey, just show me tits. But I'm just saying like, we have to get out of this phase. Like, if a consenting male or female actress and someone says, you know what would make this scene pretty hot is if I took my top off. We should not sit there and be ashamed because we're attracted to that or find that attractive. And I think we're in that point because
I think you're right.
Movies these days are purposefully made. I mean, I think that's, I know that Poor Things, it does go a little harder than a lot of like sex movies of the 80s and 90s.
It sure does.
But I wonder if a percentage of that shock is because we just don't see stuff like that in movies.
I think you're right. Like,
you know what I mean?
We're old enough to see there's been far more. I mean, don't get me wrong, Poor Things goes hard, you know, with a lot of that. But like in terms of like use your word, gratuitousness, like for the purposeless version of nudity or sex, compared to, does it have a point for the story, or does it have a growth piece for the character? Is it a core principle of what's happening in the narrative? We've seen far worse examples of that than Poor Things.
Sure.
You know, while Poor Things shows plenty of stuff, like by the time we see that dad demonstrating sex to his sons with Emma Stone, like, yes, I mean, it's shot to make it look like those kids are there, but of course those kids weren't there. Like, we hear like, Yorgos isn't that weird, but he's going to make it look weird for us for a movie. And you're right, though, because we don't see that stuff anymore, or the last time that it was even close to that, it was like the taboo movie of the taboo book of the whole 50 Shades trilogy. Because we don't see this as often, you're right, people are like unprepared for it. And I'm not saying you'd have to have Danielle on take her top off. No. I'm just saying have a passionate love scene. Well, have a passion, have more sparks to their characters than a boat ride and a couple of beers in the lunch.
I guess what I'm trying to say.
Sizzle. I call the sizzle in my review. It's kind of like, that's the level I said. It was like, just have, I start with chemistry first and then get to sizzle. But yeah.
I guess my point is that there is that middle ground of like, there's no one in the world. We walk around this world, especially if you're single, looking for your mate, right? Part of that, yes, you want to find someone who's smart and intelligent and has all these things, but part of that is also attraction.
Sure.
And I think we've had a disconnect of like, if like, seriously, because there's like all those discussions on Twitter about like how sex isn't necessary in movies and all this stuff.
Yeah.
We shouldn't be ashamed of our animal instincts. Okay.
No.
And
you, as a movie, you just have to, I mean, choose your spots and use it right.
Well, exactly. You know? Use it right. I mean, but also there's a place for crazy nudity too. I mean, exploitation films, if you can be exploitative with the violence and make something that's
thing,
purposefully like, crazy or purposefully self-aware or whatever, like you can also have things like nudity and stuff like that too. Mm-hmm. I think there's a place for it. I'm sure Katie Glidewell is a perfect example. Mm-hmm. I know powerful, strong, independent women mm-hmm. that are feminist that love 80s horror despite the fact that there's boobs everywhere, because they don't necessarily look at that. I'm not speaking for everybody. I'm just saying.
No.
It's but like example. A lot of women I know that love horror, it's not like they're bothered by the fact that, oh God, there's another girl's boobs again.
Well, that's why, like, that's why I default.
It's a middle ground.
Yeah. And that's why I default back to Lauren, our friend Lauren. Like, just the word horny. Horny doesn't mean you have to go fuck. You just have that urge. Have some characters that have outwardly or inwardly, or just even like as a piece to their emotionality, have a little fucking urge. You know, again, you don't have to act on it. You don't have to be a horn dog about it. You don't have to be criminal about it. But like, show a little appeal, show a little interest, show a little urge.
And that was
horny.
That was a criticism of, you know, the superhero movies. It's something I actually agreed with.
I do too.
I see this as a male and female thing.
Like, yes, agreed.
If we're going to idolize these superheroic people before their mm-hmm. values as people, but we also are creatures of nature, like, why would I not want to see a completely jacked and naked Chris Hemsworth and a completely super strong, you know, whatever, whoever, Scarlett Johansson, whatever.
But Chris Hemsworth should be required to take his shirt off in every movie when you look that damn fucking good.
Right. And what I'm saying is, like, there is no shame in wanting to see the perfection of someone who has molded their body into whatever beauty is considered the beauty standards, and wanting to see that in some kind of, even in a just a, ooh, I want to look at that. There's a reason why there's places like strip clubs and Chippendales and things like that, because sometimes you just want to engage with your base instincts, and we should not be ashamed of that. So I guess my point is, bring it back to Roadhouse. Roadhouse might have been a little bit exploitative in terms of its choice of nudity at time to time. Mm-hmm. But this one just doesn't have any fire or sizzle or horniness or anything.
I mean,
because just I think we're afraid to do that these days. They're just, you know what I mean?
Or they assign, the closest we get in this movie is assigned to the craziest fucking character. It's Conor McGregor walking around with his junk out, with his junk on his ass out, approaching random strangers in an exploitative way. Like that, like now all of a sudden you take that urge or emotion or the things we're looking for and you assign it to the negative character instead of the heroic character. Heaven forbid a hero be horny, you know, heaven forbid a hero have urge, you know, like. Look what we've done to it. We've put it on the bad guy. Like, that's not the best place to put it either. So
it's I guess if somebody decides to, I mean, we're not that popular, but you know, if someone decides to isolate some audio on this, I'm not saying like, please, everyone should be naked all the time. I'm not saying that. There's a time and place for everything. And there's a respect level for everything. I think if you're in an office, if you're like, take your top off, that's probably inappropriate. It's not the setting and the place. If I'm watching a movie about sexy men and women fighting in a roadhouse, I don't really see the problem of wanting to see said sexy people naked. I don't see, because it's the right setting. I'm in a movie. I've paid for it. It has consenting adults in it.
Yeah.
I have no issues with that. There's a time and place for everything. Movies are fantasy land. So
I agree.
We should stop being so scared of engaging in our base instincts.
Yeah. I'm not saying you, and I think you said this too, and I'll echo it with you. Like, you didn't have to do this like the 89 one. Like, you don't need Julie Michaels and you don't need the wet G-string contest.
Sure.
Just have passion where it belongs, which is between two good people. Like you said, consenting people, just more chemistry, more sizzle between the doctor and our good bouncer. And it would go a long way.
It's interesting. That might be a future editorial, because like, it does seem like whenever
erotic thrillers and sex scenes and movies and,
but how it's changed, because it's funny, you mentioned like how they're kind of assigning the awkward nudity to kind of the goofy.
Oh yeah. Look at the Baywatch movie a couple years ago where the only guy naked in the movie is the fat guy.
Yeah.
You know, it's not Zac Efron. It's not Alexandra Daddario. You know,
I feel like there's two methods of doing this now. Is you either have something hyper realistic, kind of like Poor Things most recently, or something that really kind of like takes the glamour of sex out. Not that
Yeah.
sex is like this you know, sex is not like the Skinemax movies where it's perfectly lit and all the bodies are perfect. I mean, sex can be this confluence of, you know, imperfect bodies and fluids and sweat this crazy stuff. But I think that they either make it super realistic so that it's not sexy in the sense of like you're taken out of the fantastical element. You're just watching people have sex, and sometimes that can be uncomfortable. Or they do attach comedy to it. Like Alexander Payne, I remember I was listening to the Sideways commentary. I used to listen to that all the time because it's Paul Giamatti and Thomas H. Church just riffing off stuff for two and a half hours. And they said, because there's two sex scenes in that movie and they're very awkward, like they're very uncomfortable and awkward. And Alexander Payne purposely said, he's like, if I'm going to show sex in my movie, I'm going to make it weird and awkward as possible.
Sure.
And I think there's really no middle ground anymore. There's none of that like 90s style of like, you knew when you were watching a 90s action movie, even if it was a third tier, like a Jean-Claude Van Damme late 90s movie, you were like,
oh, sure.
Okay.
Somebody's getting laid.
Somebody will be getting laid before the final fight, right?
Even those movies, and it's not hard to stylistically shoot it with or without nudity. I look at like Out of Sight, the great George Clooney, Jennifer Lopez meet in the bar, but the sex scene that they'll have later is interspersed and just the music's kicking, editing's kicking. Not a bared body in that scene, but it's hot as fuck.
Yeah, people say that movie overall is so sexy, and it's not even, I mean, characters are never naked. So.
No, and even if you're gonna do nudity, it can still be fleeting glances, like Desperado. That great Candles and Santana sex scene with Hayek and Banderas, where both are good looking bodies and they're naked, but it's not like, you know, titties in your face naked. It's just fastly edited, moves with the music, Candles are there, and it's just hot. When done right, it can be done without being exploitative.
Dude, art since caveman drawings has had naked hot people in it. I mean, it's the art form should not change. It's almost super conservative in a way. And I am going to say this. I do think this Roadhouse suffers from that. And you agree with me too.
I do.
It's because there really is this lack of part of the sexiness of the original is that there was this sweaty,
you want Patrick Swayze.
Vibe.
Yeah. Right. And you want Patrick Swayze. Patrick Swayze wants other people too. Like, he's into the doctor super hard. I don't know if Jake's ever into the doctor. Like,
I know this sounds weird, but like, I'm not really attracted to anyone in this. And like, I kind of miss that. I mean, don't get me wrong. Like, John Hall's body is to die for. And Daniela, whatever her last name is, very pretty to look at, as is Frankie. And there's a lot of like, what I guess we would call like TikTok beauty now. A lot of people with well-placed tattoos and jewelry and certain shirts on and stuff. But it doesn't feel sexy to me. Like, I don't feel attracted to those people. Like, you can, in that one scene in the first Roadhouse in the barn, like, you can feel
oh my gosh.
Like, you can feel the sexuality. Uh-huh. This one has none of that. Like, it doesn't. And I think that's a drawback to a lot of movies, you know? Am I saying there's a place for a sex scene in, you know, freaking Thor 4? No. But there's time and place. But, like, something like this, which is a very adult movie that adults are going to choose to watch.
I agree.
Consenting adults, like, just add some, I want to be titillated and attracted to people. Like,
I agree.
That's how we function as a society. So the movie definitely needs that. The first one might go a little overboard sometimes, but at least it has that energy.
Right.
This doesn't have any.
No, I sure
don't. This has no energy to it in terms of outside of the fighting, which I thought was. I thought the fighting was pretty good. I'm not a big fan of.
I thought it was awesome.
I'm not a big fan of the sped up hits. It actually kind of reminds me. I don't know if you've ever seen. Oddly enough, I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Irreversible.
I don't remember this one. Vincent Cassell, Monica Bellucci.
It's the one with the 9-minute rape scene. It's very disturbing. There's an equally disturbing scene in that movie. Very early, where a bunch of people think the guy that raped Monica Bellucci, because the movie is backwards.
Right.
They kill this guy at a club with like a fire extinguisher. They like basically bludgeon this guy's face to death. And it was 2003, I think, 2004-ish.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So, you know, there's really no way for, you know, I mean, in horror movies, you could do a quick cutaway and then show a guy's head explode or something. But this was kind of shot like one take. So the only way to really do it was to kind of show the impact and then kind of digitally like disfigure this guy's face until it's just a bunch of pulp and you can't see it anymore. It's very disturbing. Like a lot of people forget about that scene because of the rape scene. It's right. awful to watch. It's very difficult, but it reminded me of that in the sense of like, there is kind of that disconnect of like, you can tell it's not really happening to the person. Like, because I mean, we know that the director is not killing someone with a fire extinguisher. So we know that it's fake, but because it's not makeup and there's a little digital effect to it, there's a couple of things where like punches are landed and it's kind of this sped up frozen thing where like the face is kind of like frozen for a second and it's a little CGI-y and looks a little off-putting.
There's a varnish here. There's a varnish here that looks like it's been assisted a little bit with the CGI, not just because of the editing and the camera work, but like you said, I'm not seeing full digital doubles. We're not watching, you know, Hulk versus Hulk in Harlem, but enough where I would trade that for just good stunt work, you know, good pull punches.
And I think there was some good ones. I think the two fights between, I did enjoy the first fight we see Dalton, and I do like the fact that he basically just bitch slaps people instead of punching him. I thought that was funny. Awesome. I thought this movie had a pretty good sense of humor. Like, I laughed out loud two or three times. The first one was when he's bitch slapped all these people to death, and then he's driving them all to the hospital, which is hilarious. That was a great comedic touch. I thought that fight was pretty good. There's a couple other ones that are whatever, but I think the two fights between, Conor McGregor and Jake Gyllenhaal were excellent. I thought they were really energetic, kinetic. They were filmed really interestingly.
Yeah.
There was a sense of savagery to it that I thought a lot of movie fights don't have. My gateway into like I'm definitely still a rank amateur when it comes to like fighting films, kung fu films and stuff like that. But you know, the first fight in a movie that I ever saw that really like engaged it because of its savagery and that extra level of intensity to it was the end fight in Lethal Weapon 4.
Ooh,
and this gave me a lot of that because like in that fight, it's ugly, it's nasty, it's choreographed, but not so much so that it looks like this. Like this kind of feels like obviously these guys choreographed it because it has to hit certain beats, but it's so savage. Like it just,
it feels like a brawl, a very well choreographed brawl, but like, I agree. It's not because even the John Wick stuff is, like really well choreographed, but like you could tell
it's balletic for me. That's more of a visual.
But like in this movie, guys miss. Guys hit a table. Shit's in the way. They fall down. Like it's slightly more realistic. Not a lot realistic, but
not a lot. But I thought
how many times is Dalton going to get stabbed in the liver in Liv? You know.
I think that sums up the experience. Is that there's some things they do really well. Some things are not handled as well and some things are missing completely. It prevents it from being the classic that the first one is. I gave the first one, the original, a higher ranking than this. I would say they're both as enjoyable, but like one seems like it just makes a little bit more sense, has enough elements to keep it afloat. This one is add stuff where it needs to add, but subtracts where it doesn't need to in times. And I think that's the difference between the two films. This one will always be second to the original, but that does not make it bad.
No, both can sit in the shelf in a happy place where, like you said it best, like when you just want to turn a movie on and have a good time, that's all it needs to be. And you've got that. Like this movie did not butt off more than it needed to chew. It didn't miss any bites from the other one. Like it just, that's just what the doctor ordered. I'm happy the two of us can come on here and champion that compared to our critical brethren who are, again, I don't know why you're looking for fucking Cormac McCarthy out of this movie or something, you know, just, I don't know what they're looking for.
Like, anymore. We're not allowed to have that anymore, man, because like if something is super popular and is mass population likes it, i.e. like Marvel, they must be bad for art, right?
Yeah,
people enjoy stuff. Oh my god. Yep. Anyways, we're coming up on the time.
Fire away, man.
Any final thoughts on?
No, those were it for me. Yeah, that's good stuff.
All right, folks. We now have merch from shirts to stickers. Find some sweet cinephile hissy fit swag on tpublic.com/user/ruminationsradio network. Follow us on Twitter at cinephilefit, on Facebook at cinephile hissy fit podcast, and Instagram at cinephilefits. Find both of us by name on Letterboxd to check out our film reviews and ratings. We are also on Rotten Tomatoes. Thank you so much for your loyal listenership and our tussles and for connecting with us on social media. Cinephile Hissy Fit is a Ruminations Radio Network podcast sponsored by Film Obsessive. If you enjoyed this show, the Ruminations Radio Network has more excellent programming with stellar hosts and spirited topics. Please rate, review, and subscribe to our show and others on iTunes, Spotify, and anywhere you find your favorite podcasts.